Welcome to the Jonathan Kaiser Podcast. This is a show that highlights successful business leaders and entrepreneurs from Arizona and beyond. I'm your host, Jonathan Kaiser, entrepreneur, CEO, father, and best-selling author. As the founder and managing partner of Kaiser Commercial Real Estate, I've been very fortunate to be able to connect with some of the smartest and most brilliant people in our country. And now, I want to tell their stories. Join me as I interview world-class executives and entrepreneurs, exploring their journeys, end games, the challenges they've overcome, and how you can model their success. Welcome back to the Jonathan Kaiser Podcast, where we highlight local business leaders here in Arizona that are doing good work in the community. And I'm very honored to have my good friend and CEO and founder of Equality Health, Hugh Lytle, here with me today. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So could you just give us a little bit of the journey? Tell us about the vision, because I remember you and I sitting down, I think it was Coffee Bean, when you were still just kind of thinking this whole concept up. And now look at it, right? Yeah, now the reality.
Yeah.
Tell us about the journey.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't even know if that Coffee Bean's still there. I think it is. But yeah, it was a journey, Jonathan, that began with kind of just a frustration with the healthcare system. Probably not too dissimilar in how you started this business with all the energy being focused on seniors in government healthcare. It's all around Medicare. And we have a very important graying of America that's going on. And it's very important we focus on that. But unfortunately, diversity was changing just as fast.
Yeah.
And this is all kind of, when we were talking pre-social justice, pre-George Floyd, pre-kind of the attention that's come on to communities of color, and saw that as an important healthcare trend at the time and said, we're doing nothing in this Medicaid program to help these people who need it the most. Thinking back to those days when, for you and I, our healthcare costs are expensive, but they're within rata of our total compensation. The per capita cost of a low-income person's growing healthcare cost on top of multi-generational households becomes untenable. It can be 50% of their entire income going out the door for just healthcare costs, just to maintain a decent lifestyle. So, you know, realized that a lot needed to be changed here. And I got fortunate that there was a new payment construct starting in America on how we pay for care called value-based care. And really, at the essence, what that is, that's an outcomes-based payment. So instead of paying you for a unit of service like I do when I go to the doctor and I have 9 minutes with a doctor and I got to go, they bill for that time. Instead of doing that, they say, okay, what's the problem? I've got uncontrolled diabetes. All right, we're going to fix the controlled diabetes. We're going to pay for that entire episode. We're going to pay that up front. And if you can manage to do that in a more efficient way, you can split what you keep with the physicians and the people who helped you and make healthcare much more affordable for the patient. So of the $4.3 trillion spent in healthcare today, a third is already being spent on value-based care, on outcomes-based payment, which is definitely showing tremendous results. And so we're one of the pioneers in using that payment mechanism that allows us to now engage a patient who is generally low-income Medicaid, apply a care model that we offer that, because their Medicaid focuses on what we call whole person care,
okay,
or their medical care, which you and I go to primary care physician, but also if you're low income, you're dealing with things like behavioral health challenges, you're dealing with substance abuse potentially, you're dealing with any type of food banks, other transportation issues. So what we do is we organize that care journey and then we help them overcome the barriers that exist to solving those problems. And that creates an outcome, that creates a lower cost event. And then we work with our health plan partners to put that in motion originally across a handful of people here in Phoenix. And now we're in 5 states, Arizona, Texas, Tennessee, Louisiana, Virginia, and now next year launching Michigan and North Carolina, and doing this model on a national basis. Now we have about 1 million lives under management.
Wow.
Yeah. We just started with a handful in Arizona, and we're doing this all in a way that lowers healthcare costs, creates greater access for the patient, and improves, most importantly, improves the quality of care for low-income.
So what was it that helped you see this vision? Like, if it was this cutting-edge program, you identified the need. I mean, what enabled you to be kind of an early adopter, first mover in this space?
It sounds corny, but it was just passion for the community, passion for the issue. Like, I just think, I have this belief that, like, the quality of your healthcare just should not be dictated by how much money you make.
I agree with that.
But it is. In this country, we have a two-tier healthcare system. Healthcare is a human right. We should be able to take care of each other. And we let politics, we let a lot of silly things get in the way of that in terms of how things are reimbursed. So that's what it started. It was really just dumb belief, and there's got to be a better way. But I'm a population health specialist. That's what I've done my whole career. So I knew I could start applying a model, and I figured I got lucky in that the financial model was changing, and there was one that could kind of tie up with it. The other thing I knew is I'd come across a piece of software that was really important to being able to do this. So when you're working with, you know, we now have almost 4,000 primary care physicians in our network that manage these patients. And when you're working with these physicians, you got to be able to get them the source of truth. So here's the condition of this patient. They were in the hospital last night. Things like that that you don't get in traditional medicine, in traditional practices. And so I came across that. I bought this company when it had like 4 employees, but it ended up being...
And that gave you the data.
Gave me the data I needed. So that was really the breakthrough moment, was when I went, okay, what I saw as an opportunity is I said, I got the data. I've got a population that's got massive need. I got a payment transformation model that's taking place. Now I got to do is put the model together and go out and hope that they'll, you know, the health plans will contract with me and buy my product. But that was another hard thing, is I had to figure out how we were learning along with the health plans how to contract.
Right. It was all new.
In the early days, it was like, how do you administer this contract? How do you put it together? How do you measure it? It's a very technical business, as you can imagine, a lot of actuarial science and measuring, you know, medical spend and cost. But we were able to do that in its early stage with a really great team that was committed and passionate. And now we've been able to scale that up, basically.
Talk a little bit about that scale, right? Like going from a few people in the local community to where you're at today, which is significant. And then talk about where you're going.
Yeah. Scaling's hard because it really comes down to, we brought in new financial partners who really helped us with this. It really comes down to really understanding what they call your unit economics, like how you break down your business into the componentry that can move across markets. Mm-hmm. And we were able to really understand what moves our business. Mm-hmm. And then once we understood that, we could also say, what's the minimal investment when we go into a market, so that we have that giant J curve of being negative on earnings for a really long time, which this business can do because you have like 12 months of claims that have to come in before you can now look and say, okay, what happened? Mm-hmm. So we get paid like every 18 months, basically, almost every 2 years. So because of that, you have to really be able to manage your working capital.
Got it.
And you got to be able to like lay out the unit economics. So a lot of it was understanding that. Second was staffing, finding leadership in new states, making sure our model fit, making sure there were plenty of independent physicians, making sure that their value-based policies at the state makes sense. And we were able to put that together in a way that now we can create a much more uniform experience market to market. Even with every state having different things they focus on Medicaid, we can adjust our model because the core framework is consistent, if that makes sense.
It does.
And so where we're going forward in the future is we want to speed up the number of states that we're doing. So we do 1 to 2 new states a year. We can easily do 3 to 4. So we'll be increasing the pace on states. We want to get to 25, 30 states, maybe 40 if we can find the ones. They won't all be the same on how we underwrite them, but ultimately we want to be in 40 states.
Are you not able to be in some states?
Some states don't have managed care. Some states, they don't hand it off their Medicaid program to a United Healthcare Center like that who can contract with us. And some states just don't have any value-based policy at all. They're all paying fee-for-service on everything, and those are obviously much less attractive states. Maybe in time, it'll happen. But anyways, the goal is to roll out to the majority of the states. And then the other thing I'm working on hard is, while every state, one of the challenges in Medicaid is that at the federal level, they tend to just kick it back to the state. So what's the state issue? It's a state issue. But that's not the right answer for a program that is the largest government program we have, bigger than Medicare, any other program we have. 90 million people on the program, a third of the country almost. You have 50% of all babies born in this country to this Medicaid program, and yet you have very little federal attention to it at an innovation level. So what we're trying to do is I was trying to spend my time working with the federal government to say, this is a really important program. It's a safety net program for our country. You may not believe in universal coverage. I understand that, but you should. And if you don't, here's at least an alternative that you can do to shore up some of the uninsured in this country. It's a very safe and easy to implement program. And so trying to push a lot in DC for consistency on how they contract, consistency and how they reward providers for participating in this program. And so that's the other big one. And then obviously the other thing is we will be likely, as we grow now, we've been almost 100% organic. We'll probably be more acquisitive in our future. And the simple way I would tell you that is that today, if you take the premium dollar that comes in for a Medicaid patient, we participate in, say, roughly 50% of that. In the future, we'll maybe take 80% of the risk instead of 50% of the risk. So in the future, we're looking at being much more of a risk partner to our health plans because we've got all the care delivery below it and more integrated
infrastructure.
As they would infrastructure. Yeah. So what I might want to do then is we call it the big tent strategy. So, and then we can help these health plans contract with these smaller groups who want these same kind of value-based care contracts, but have a small number of membership. We can consolidate them and administer it for them and then start to integrate the care. So we have a big strategy on organizing value-based within a health plan, taking more of the premium, but delivering more risk or taking more risk, but providing more, using more of that premium for care delivery, and then potentially acquiring components of that, like high-risk maternity, like behavioral health, that are real challenges for these health plans because they're not integrated. And then creating the chassis underneath that they can be turnkey as we scale up.
So do you have significant competitors today that are trying to do what you're doing in the same sort of 40-plus state strategy?
No, our biggest competitor is status quo. I mean, people who just want to keep fee-for-service and don't really commit.
Don't rock the boat.
Don't commit to value-based. Ultimately, I think they lose the mindshare of providers. So physicians can't barely make a living at all on Medicaid. So they've got to have an opportunity to share in some of the collective savings that they create by creating a better health outcome. Physicians need skin in the game to be successful, basically. And I think that the other thing is when you're running in Medicaid, we've been often called the grocery store of healthcare because we run at such small margin, high transaction, a lot of members.
Make it up in volume.
Small margins, right? So our SG&A, our operating costs are 20%, 30% of what a Medicare
would
be. So there are companies that do what we do in value-based care and Medicare, but for them to come our direction, they're going to have to figure out how to shed.
How to get 10, lean.
10 basis points of operating costs.
That's not easy to do.
So it's not something that people are going to come rushing into. I do think we'll have more competition in time. And for the most part, it's the inertia of status quo that's the biggest
challenge. I mean, you become an acquisition target by one of these folks at some point.
Yeah, but you know, like we've already had that. Based on where I'm at in my life right now, and I've sold companies way too soon in the past, like this is not a company for sale. We may add additional capital, but the goal is to stay independent and keep growing because the need is huge. And as soon as we go to a competitor or we get sold, there's no guarantee that things carry on, right? So, yeah.
Right. I mean, if this is your mission and you don't want to have it.
Yeah, it's a mission. Why would you do that? A lot of the people in the industry are telling me the same thing. They're like, you know, really want to see this company stay independent. Yeah.
That's cool. So we're sitting in this amazing new building in the boardroom. Talk a little bit about your real estate journey and how much effort you put in trying to figure out what you wanted to do and then how we got to this amazing place.
Well, it's funny. We're just talking about that before you got here. You know, I got known in town, I think, as a professional shopper. Lots of kicked a lot of tires. And I would tell you, it's been a journey in the sense that we started in a downtown warehouse district and we had the old Cooperstown. Remember that? That was one of our buildings. And we had
a cool building.
Yeah, cool building. We had another building that was, you know, and they were great when we started because they were kind of edgy and entrepreneurial and a lot of fun. And we being urban presence was really important to us, but we just outgrew them. And the growing pains were really difficult. And the parking, there was just a lot of challenges. We were running into security. And so as we started getting pressure, and I started seeing really early, like, we're going to probably outgrow these things. We're going to need to start thinking about what's next. And I could just never see a Medicaid business like ours in a marble lobby like high rise. So it was a challenging time to try to figure out what do we need? How do we do it? And we had some false starts with some other groups that just well-intended, but some of the reasons I think Kaiser is so successful is the true focus on the independent part of independent broker. Like, we were kind of being put into buildings that there was some kind of relationship. Those were the priority ones we had to go to first. As spending, I don't have a lot of time trying to build this business. I was spending a lot of time going into because it had no, made no sense to why we'd even consider him.
Because it was in the best interest of the broker showing you.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Versus your best.
Versus my best interest. And I didn't know that at the time. I just thought, wow, why are we here? And here's a list. Here's a list. Here's a list. And, you know, I look at a list. I see a building. I don't know what it means until I get out there. And it just wasn't done right. And so I'm going, wait a minute. We got this leading company in this country that is like doing this amazing mission that's getting huge visibility all over the country. We need a headquarters that represents that. I'm going to be hiring people that need to come and feel like, hey, this is a substantial company I want to work for, not one that looks like an edgy, like, do I need to see your financial statements before I start?
You're no longer a startup.
Yeah, exactly. So right. What do we do? And so that's when you and I start talking. And I'm like, we need someone to understand our business, understand what we're trying to get done strategically. And we need someone to help us like engage with our employee population about how do we think about this collectively. I mean, we're a very tight group. We call ourselves healthcare rebels. We do things very unique and very different and very aggressive. So like we all want to be in on the solution. And I remember, you know, we sat down and we talked about it, you and I did, and you said, like, put me in. Let me show you what I can do. I know you've been burned on some of these things here in the past, but promise you we'll do the work. And from there, it was really pretty amazing what you guys did in terms of stepping in with, first, a complete strategy review. And when I say strategy review, Jonathan, what sticks out the most to me is it wasn't a, all right, let's just get that done so I can get on to showing Houston buildings. It was like literally like trying to understand exactly what we're trying to, what does our business mean? What does it mean to the community? What does it mean to people coming to our facility? We went through a lot on perceptions and where my goals were. You know, I told you about some of the goals I had in the building. And from there, that journey became much more focused around that. And then I'll say we can talk a little bit more about like how we did all the assessments and all the other kind of things. But I can just tell you strategically, us connecting strategically on where this business is, where it's going, and what the headquarters needed to represent to me and to my executive team was job one. You guys killed it there.
Thank you. Yeah, I remember a lot of those discussions, right? And they weren't always easy. Right? Because you had a lot of different factors to consider. Some of them seemed inherently challenging, right? Like when you're trying to be very mindful of cost, yet you needed to have something that displayed success and that you were a real company. Talk to us about how you felt about this building. I remember texting you and saying, man, you got to see this one.
Yeah. Well, if you remember, we were looking, there was another one that was a pretty good building, but really struggling with the location. You know, it was like, it just could not see us there. A lot of industrial type traffic and stuff. And it was one of those things where, you know, it was just kismet. We knew, like, as soon as you told me it was on the, you know, it was on the Salt River Pima Reservation, I was like, okay, that one of the big requirements we have was that there has to be some cultural high ground here.
Yes.
There has to be a connection. There's plenty of office buildings that are out there. Like, we need it to tie to the kind of communities that we serve, right? So being on the reservation was a huge benefit to us in terms of how we thought about it. And the other thing, what I would say is, you know, it's a good market, right? I mean, you guys did a great job negotiating, but we were also kind of stepping into a time where they might be willing to give things they wouldn't have given before, right? Yeah. So it made it financially more feasible for us to say, well, we can sublease these buildings. We can step into this new facility without it, you know, being a crushing blow. And then also in terms of how you structured the deal, in terms of how much of the building we can use now versus how much we'll use in the future. Those were all like huge prereqs to us being able to successfully do this. But when I got to the building, it was game over. I mean, just when you pull up the view, the grandeur, even though I think this is a high class B, is it? I think.
I consider it an A.
Yeah, it looks like an A. It feels like a straight A completely from people that come in. And so gorgeous lobby, gorgeous entry. And, you know, you and I talked a lot about, like, I had this vision at the time for a diversity museum in the base of whatever building we found, which turned out to be like really not feasible to do and a security challenges. But what we did come up with was kind of a community hub where we could put in a community art and do art that's representative of the communities that we serve. And so downstairs in our lobby, one of the coolest things we've got about this building is we have people of color that have sell their art in this area, but it also provides, we let community organizations use our boardroom. There's that beautiful beautiful granite boardroom down there that we were allowed, that we let them use that, then they can mingle. We've had a number of events already just in that art area where it's just, and have the artists in and have them talk about it. It's really, really cool. So just that alone on the aesthetics was really powerful. But then, you know, a lot of character in the building, a lot of unique breakout spaces we were looking for, hoteling spaces. You guys had some really great ideas on how to reconfigure a hot kitchen that we didn't need to make it the space more amenable to employee lunches and kind of group get-togethers down there, and pickleball court, weight room, fitness facilities. I mean, all that was in this and was just a no-brainer. But now we got a deal cut, right? And this wasn't the cleanest thing to do, right? I mean, there's a lot, had subleases, have a lot to...
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of times companies don't really see what's possible if you don't take the time on the front end to do the, I like to call it strategery, right? Mm-hmm. The strategic thinking on the front end to then kind of come up with solutions that may not be inherently obvious. Yeah. And I think this is a perfect example of it, right? Totally. Like you said, to grow into the space, the fact that you're in a class A building paying class B minus rates. I mean, those are just real special opportunities that may not always be in the broker's best interest, mm-hmm. right? But they're certainly in your best interest.
Well, I'll give you props even on this room, this boardroom. So boardroom being the most important to me. It's where I spend a lot of my time as chairman. And we have a lot of outside investors, or a handful of outside investors that come in. And there were not, we had one oversized one downstairs that didn't make sense. We wanted to reconfigure for the community boardroom, but we wanted one that was accessible to my office, accessible mm-hmm. to the restrooms, accessible to the elevators. And you guys helped brainstorm this area. We reconfigured completely. And
it turned
even down to the table. Yeah, it's just really a fantastic setup. Couldn't be happier.
It was going to be hard to beat your last one. Remember your old circle table?
Yeah,
then that thing was awesome,
that
too.
That was cool.
Yeah. And it fit with your logo and all of that.
But
this really did turn out awesome. So obviously, I'm in a commercial real estate is a very competitive industry, right? And I'm sure your phone still rings off the hook with everybody calling with every pitch. I would love for just, if you're willing to share a little bit more about kind of what the experience was like working with us versus maybe more of the traditional firm. Like, what was that experientially like for you?
Yeah, it's the way it's supposed to work. I mean, I guess it'd be the easiest way to say it. You know, you'd think this would be easy and then be consistent, but you're a rare diamond in this that just, it's hard to find. So not just the strategy, which was critical, right? How do we end up in a cultural place? You listen to our cultural needs and how important this was to us. It really came down to the team that you assembled that were part, you know, obviously you're great and we know that, but like, the team that was you brought to work with us, from project leads and project management through the interior design firm that really lined up with the vision we had for the place, your talent and assessment team that helped us get the employee surveys and identify what was most important to them, working with our HR group. I mean, again, something that these sometimes are bulleted on your competitors' things, but it doesn't happen. Okay.
Right.
It tends to be sometimes just a, okay, we hear kind of what you're looking for. You're looking for this much square foot, how many plates, a few qualifying questions, and then here's a list. And let's go. And then a lot of pressure to get to a lease always.
Like, come on.
Well, there's always a scenario, right? There's always, got Peloton's looking at the space, you know, whatever. You're like, okay. Like, we have to all of a sudden now do a knee-jerk emotional purchase of office space that we're going to spend the next 10 years. And this is not going to happen. So you guys were patient. I would say that was probably the most unusual attribute for this line of work. This, from my experience, from where I sit in it, not being that close to it, very patient with us, making sure that we front-ended this thing with our needs first and what we were looking for. And then it made, I mean, honestly, John, I don't know what you think, but like, it made the buying, we didn't look at like 30 buildings. We looked at like a handful. Mm-hmm. And this one, you knew, was special, and bam, we got it done. So, but the team was, you know, fully functional, fully representative of all the different components we needed to be successful, including all the way into move-in. I mean, just fully supportive of the team we had. We had assembled our own team, and they worked great together, and it's the way it's supposed to work.
I love that. You had used a term, I can't remember exactly what it was, but in describing some of the experience you've had. I think it was like space, I don't remember what the term was, space pushers or space something. And I think that that is most people's experience, right? Most people's experience is brokers just trying to hurry up and get them to do a deal so they can get paid and move on.
Yeah.
And really, from my perspective, what you needed was someone to care about your organization and try to help you find both short and longer term solutions.
Well, and I would tell you this, John, I would expect that out of any broker firm. Okay, I expect that. I wouldn't expect it out of a tenant broker. But even your competitors to yours that are tenant brokers or space have alignments and entanglements and are always as, I guess, non-biased as maybe they could be or should be. So that was maybe one of the hardest things. I kept wondering why I find myself in situations and then started looking and think, well, maybe it's me. Maybe we're not explaining this or doing this right. There was just no voice to listen to it because it seemed highly transactional and not like something I'm going to invest my time in. I thought, well, maybe we're just wrong. Maybe we got to do this ourselves until you and I sit down. So yeah, but definitely a huge, and this is why I sing Kaiser Song wherever I go, is that it's just such a huge, and this isn't my first company. So I've had this in other companies as well. And usually I'm working with my CFO in that case. And it's just the same dynamic. It's just find some space, lease it out. But an office is your home. It is an emotional place. It's a place that we go during our days when we're not with our families. And we want to break down some of that coldness that exists in that world. And it takes, you know, I think we're not the norm. I don't think we're the exception in that anymore. I think people really want a place they can identify with and be proud of. And just, I can't say enough about the comprehensive approach you guys took and the team and everything to get us where we are.
Well, I appreciate the kind words. You know, we're often probably very similar to you. We're often in a very thankless industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you hear all about the things that aren't perfect, but you don't get a lot of accolades. So that's very appreciated. Talk about, as you look forward, how do you see your needs changing, if at all, when it comes to how you occupy space? Do you feel like everybody's gone through this pandemic transition? Maybe talk a little bit about how you're doing it. I know we did a ton of work getting here. Mm-hmm. I think we did probably a lot more than other companies do. Mm-hmm. And there's still a lot of companies I'm working with today that are still trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that piece of it.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of this comes down to the leadership, and I'm old school, so I believe people need to be at work. Like, I'm not big on the hybrid thing. I understand it. I mean, there's always been positions in any organization that are field-based, and that's a good third of any business anyways, if not half. So, but when you get into building a growth business, okay, if you're at a widget manufacturer and you guys are growing 10% a year or less, and okay, great, I get it. But if you're in a high growth 30, 40, 50, 60% CAGR business, you got to be there. You got to be part of the blood that's flowing in those veins of the hallways. You can't be dialing in and waving from a Zoom call. So that being said, we are tolerant. We are understanding of the impact that COVID had on people. We are understanding of a changing paradigm in the workforce, on and on and on. But as I often say, and my chief of staff, Cheryl, there left because she has to hear this too many times, but I will take a B player who's willing to work their butt off and come to the office any day over an A player that's a prima donna and can't seem to make it in. And that is, I think, the recipe for success. And so we want to give them a killer environment. They need to come to a place that kicks ass when they're here.
Like, yes.
And we've had tremendous results. There's tremendous feedback on the building itself. But we're still like anybody. We're still having to now get to the, like, all right, how many of your employees didn't make it in a day? We're starting to check badges. We're starting to like make sure that we're getting the activity, but we want to make sure it's productive activity. We want the activity just to be, I showed up at the office. It needs, how are you engaged? How are you engaging when you were there? So we spend, you know, a lot of energy on that. I think as we go forward, we'll continue to press for that. We'll probably end up getting to a 4-day work week at some point.
And
here,
currently
we're at three. And then we'll always probably have a virtual Friday because it's a good flex. Somehow you get more work done when you don't have to do the work, you know, but now we're, when I think about future office space needs and how we build out, a lot of this right now is focused on how do we build our culture out in non-traditional ways. So don't know if it's right or not, but we're trying to figure out ways to create like executive pods that go to different markets and work out of that office for a week or two, like trying to start to rotate so that we can keep people. Sometimes are slave to the corporate office. You know what I mean? It's like back in Phoenix, this is how they do what they think. our Texas business is already bigger than our Arizona business.
Wow.
So in just a few years of contracting, it'll be a million lives on its own at some point. So we need to start thinking about what are the other Phoenix type offices? What do they look like? How large are they? So right now, like, for example, we're thinking it's either Houston or Dallas. Probably Houston is our next big MSA that we would build a larger office in so that people have an HQ to go to. Maybe Nashville as well, maybe not as big, but based on the market size and opportunity. But what is that third major MSA going to be? And I think as we scale up, which we think we can be a $10, $20 billion company in the next 5 to 10 years, as we do that, we're going to need to have scaled facility operations. Yeah. They can't just be outpost depots of place for people to plug in computers and two or three execs to work. It's going to have to be more robust of a of an office environment. So we're going to try to figure out how do we carry over culture here to there, commonality, looks and feels, everything, so that you feel like you're operating in a single physical plant.
Right. Even though you're not.
You're not. Yeah.
What was the word you used again for the executives going around?
I just call it like executive pods, but basically.
I think that's brilliant.
I'm just trying to think. We're trying to think creatively of just to have someone fly in for a day is no big deal, but like, how could we figure out a way to work for a week out of the different mixture of execs so that people are already off? You're showing your commitment, which hopefully they show their commitment by being there and experiment with some other ideas. But I think the main thing is, though, is to how do you impart culture into the organization so that it's not all about headquarters, that everybody feels that they're part of Equality Health no matter where they're at.
I think that's wonderful. Could you touch just quickly on your culture and how you would describe it?
Yeah, like I said, we were healthcare rebels. We break glass. We've always been critical thinkers in our space. I'm most proud of the fact, sometimes I say the entrepreneur is the spark, but the eternal flame is the management team. And they're the ones that get it done. They're the ones that do all the amazing work. And we have an unbelievable team. We have the most talented team in the country at what we do. And so when I think about culture, I think about high EQ, high IQ teams that think, treat each other with respect, have passion, and as the underlying thing and what they're doing, there has to be some egalitarian component of what works. If you're going to do well at our company, there's other companies you go to where you might just be super smart and do well, make a lot of money.
Plenty of them out there.
Plenty of them out there. But if you don't have that kind of currency, that current level that runs inside of you that says, I'm here to do good, you're going to not fit in as well. Because we do some things, sometimes it just don't make sense because we care about our clients and our patients and our doctors. So I think that's part of it. I think we also have a business that is highly fragmented because the Medicaid system is fragmented. So you've got all these different pockets of skill sets. So I think we've been able to figure out how to harness all that and what we call mission moments, but kind of ways where we can tell a story about how our entire model helped really improve someone's life at the highest level. And sometimes they even speak how it improved their life at our company town halls. But I think those kind of things.
I think that's key, right? Because
my contribution? I'm in IT.
Right.
How did I help this happen?
Yeah.
Right. Well, here's how you draw the line on how I just came from a meeting. We have a few huddle lunches we do with our leaders just to make sure, like, what am I out doing? They don't see me as much. I'm traveling a lot. What are you doing here? And then I ask them, what do you want to ask me? And I get tremendous feedback. That was one of the things we talked about just recently was one of our leaders said, the greatest value I've been able to do within the company is showing how your one function ties to that patient not going back into the skilled nursing facility because they were dehydrated or had some other issue arise because we engaged.
Right.
And so they wouldn't have had the data. They wouldn't have, because you provide that data wouldn't have been accurate. And therefore, this wouldn't have happened, right? Being able to draw those lines back means a lot. Then you can get into your personal mission and the work you do. So those are just some examples, but I would just definitely call our culture one that is valued on entrepreneurism. It's valued on independent critical thinking. Mm-hmm. It's valued on creativity and innovation, and to a lesser degree on corporate stuff.
Right. Less corporate stuff. I like that. That's a good tagline.
Yeah.
Less corporate stuff.
The bigger we get, the harder it is to fight from that. But man, it can be the stranglehold of a great company.
I think it's exciting for me. I just flew back from Chicago, where I was at for a conference this weekend, and I'm pulling into going down the airport to the SkyTrain, and you know, there's a really cool equality health sign. Right. And, and I think your messaging is so dialed in, right? Like it really does convey the heart of the founder, right? It's something that we've tried to do a lot at Kaiser is convey the passion, the mission. So
I'll turn the table on you. Tell me about your culture. You built an amazing culture. That's why you guys are so differentiated.
I mean, our culture is we're in an industry, as you know, that is very cutthroat. Dog eat dog. It's all about the next deal. Doesn't kind of matter how you get to the top. You want to have your picture as the top guy. And it is usually guys. And so we've really created this culture of care, of selfless service, of really trying to help ensure that we're delivering on the brand promise that you just described in very good terms. And I'm grateful for that. So,
and don't you think, I mean, wouldn't you say that, like, what I said about patience, that is a great indicator of your different approach, right? Because the patience was one thing I can tell you after I've tried a couple different firms over the last, before I came in with you guys, that did not exist. It was, let's go. It was not like, let's take the time to understand what the real needs are. And then when it was done, it was an easy exercise.
I appreciate that. And I agree. I think from my perspective, as I think about it, what we do as a culture is something that we all inherently as humans know how to do at some level, right? It's take care of people. And what does take care of people mean? That means you put their interests ahead of your own. I think that's the fundamental flaw with not only commercial real estate brokerage, but business in general, right? Is people are putting their own personal interests ahead of the people they're supposed to be serving. And I believe fundamentally that if you love and serve other people, it comes back. And I think of it in a very practical sense, right? Like if my focus is on helping you get what you want in a deal that's structured the way you want it so that you and I are able to have this experience where we're talking about it and it's been a very positive outcome, that's good in the long run for me, right? Because that means you trust me. That means you're going to work with me in the future, right? So to me, it seems so inherently simple, Hugh. It's like, take ridiculously good care of people, love on them. We all make mistakes. When you make a mistake, admit it. Right? Screw that one up. Man, I'm going to do better next time. Instead of hide it or whatever.
You hit the nail on the head there. It's, you've got longevity or longitudinality versus transactional, right? I mean, like when we start to talk about, like, let's say Houston's our next, hey, get Jonathan on the phone. What are we going to do? Like, it's not even a question, right?
Yeah.
If you were transactional, flipped us into space, we had a bunch of things that we found out later that, you know, came out, then we're going to go, yeah, that wasn't a great experience. What are we going to do? Like, we're starting over again, right? And some firms are willing to take that, I think. But like, that's,
it's not the long
term thinking.
Yeah. It is short term thinking. Yeah. So I know we're running out of time here. I'm going to look at my non-watch. I know we're running out of time here, but I also want to talk about the Quality Health Foundation. I have such a amazing organization and you're doing such work. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm really proud of our Equality Health Foundation and the leader, Tomas Leon, who's just done tremendous work with. He's a man of the community. We call him our chief heart officer. He's got a big
he's a good man.
Good guy. But it is also was very strategic for us. So when I created the foundation, it was because, again, go back to our business mission. We're here to help underserved communities achieve the highest individuals to achieve the highest, most optimum level of health that they can. And we do it through this whole person care model. And what I came to realize is that that's awesome for who we're doing this for people we're contracted to do it for. But it's not everybody. And you, at some point, you know, this is a mission-oriented business and you start going, man, but what about the people who can't get access to a quality health? I mean, that kind of sucks, right? So we came up with this idea of wrapping around our LLC, a not-for-profit organization that could become a, what we call a convener, an opportunity to go out and raise funds from various groups that want to support Equality Health, but have the same issue. Like we're only touching so many members. And now it allows us to go so much further. Now we can go beyond just our membership and deeper into the community, right? We can go, let me give you an example. It was after the shooting in Uvalde, Texas, right? That was one of the most devastating things ever. Community was in healing. Equality Health Foundation, along with one of our clients, Centene Corporation and Walmart, went in and put together a Christmas program to reach out to the community to allow them to heal, you know, to come in, to give away gifts to kids, to allow them a safe place to come. And we gave away food items as we always do. We gave away Christmas turkeys and Thanksgiving turkeys as well. We do this in a way that like allows our mission to extend, allows people to have access to it who wouldn't have otherwise. And one of the cool things about this new space we have is that we're able to put it together in the same building now, right? So one of the neat things that we have is in that, in our lobby where we have community artists displayed, people of color that paint in our local community. We also have a community facility that they can use for meetings and other types of gatherings and programs. And so we've had all kinds of people come through, and it's a great way to showcase not only for them to meet other people in the community and showcase the art, but also showcase that Equality Health as an organization has a social responsibility and is living up to that social responsibility by bringing everybody together. And it makes me really proud.
I must just say, I think we are so grateful. I know you're a humble man, Hugh, and we are grateful for your leadership in this community and for what you're doing to help the health outcomes of so many people that have been historically underserved. I get the chills even saying it. Like, I'm really grateful for your vision and your willingness to take the risk to make that a reality. And I'm really excited for the organization, for the benefits that all your million plus and growing members are receiving, and also that I get to play a small role in it. So thanks for your leadership, and thanks for being just, again, for just to say it. I know you get a lot of accolades, but I find you to be one of the most authentically genuine people that I know. And you don't say what you don't mean. And you're also very gracious with people, even when they don't necessarily do what you need them to do. I watched you throughout the process when different folks didn't necessarily give their best in that second. And you, the way that you handle it is you're a class act. And I'm grateful to know you as a friend and as a business associate. And I also look forward to seeing how the impact of your leadership in this community trickles out and affects others, right? Because you're kind of become this beacon of what a leader can be that I know a lot of younger people are aspiring to become.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate it. And back at you, authenticity is, to me, one of the leading characteristics in leadership. No one follows someone they don't believe in or trust. And you do a great job with it as well at Kaiser. So honored to be your friend, and thank you so much for the amazing work you did in this project.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to hit subscribe so future episodes are automatically downloaded directly to your device. And if you want access to today's show notes, including links to all the resources mentioned, visit Kaiser.com/podcast. That's KEYSER.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening, and I will catch you next week for another episode of the Jonathan Kaiser Podcast.